Hello, fellow travelers, and welcome to the Traversing the Stars podcast. How are my loyal listeners? Thank you for your continued support. As always, hit that subscribe button, everybody. We have an amazing show for y'all because boarding the mothership is Philip Kennedy Johnston. You know him as the writer of Action Comics and Alien. He is now the writer of The World Without a Justice League, Green Lantern. Now come join me as we go traversing the stars. Hello, Mr. Johnston. Thank you so much for coming to the Traversing the Stars podcast.
My pleasure, man. Thanks for having me back.
It's always my pleasure to talk with you, sir. You are fantastic to talk with, and you also do great work. So it works for me both ways. So I always start off with a question of inspiration. So what inspired your love for writing, and who were your earliest influences?
My love for writing. A big part of that was more about just it's kind of hardwired into me, I guess. Like, my inspiration for doing it is I just always just wanted to make things, whether it be like with my hands or like drawing or writing music or whatever. It's just something that's always kind of driven me. And probably my earliest influences. my dad read to me a lot as a kid, but not often kid stuff. Like, it was usually like much more like Mark Twain and like Macbeth was
stuff, that's awesome
stuff that you wouldn't expect, you know. I remember really digging Macbeth and liking the supernatural aspect to it. I mean, I'm sure if you were to ask me as a kid, like a young kid, about what Macbeth is about and like all the little nuance, I'm sure I was losing a lot of it. But just the fact that I was exposed to it, and the stuff and the creepier parts of Huck Finn and those kind of things too, Tom Sawyer. They left a real impact on me, and I just really kind of fell in love with English language. And part of that was from the dialect, how different everyone spoke, especially in Mark Twain, but also in other stuff too. When the writer really did a great job of differentiating the voices, that was a big deal to me. And that's something I discovered later on when I was reading like C.S. Lewis and Tolkien stuff too. Those elements, and also elements like in Tolkien, when he would write songs and poems and other little stories within the stories, that always really captured me. Just made the world feel more real, you know. And to a lesser degree, also like the way Alan Moore added the Black Freighter into Watchmen, and how it the idea that comics in that world were not about superheroes because those were all around them. They were about pirates and stuff like that. Like this little things like that, where you see the culture of the world that you're reading about, just went such a long way. So I don't know. I really loved it, those little tricks that the writers did. I guess those are some of the influences that come to my mind. The earliest.
That's awesome, because it reminds me so much. Like growing up, I remember my father reading Grimm's fairy tales to me and my sister. Yeah. I thought that was fantastic. And like I said, and Lord of the Rings. I will say, I don't think there's ever been a better example of world building than Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, I have to agree. For me, when I was writing The Last God, actually one of my big influences was Silmarillion. And not for the storytelling, because there's not really much storytelling in it. It's kind of like this Old Testament kind of just purely world-building narrative without much of a character-driven story in it. It's mostly just like the story of this world. But as far as world-building, it's like a masterclass. So I really admired that. And I did try to remember the fact, like, now this, even though I really get into those kinds of things, like those scholarly kind of documents, I tried to remember and recognize that it's not really a story in the way that The Hobbit or Lord of the Rings are. Like, those are narratives driven by character and built around character, and not like that's, the Silmarillion does not do that. But as far as just the pure world building aspect, that was a big influence on me for sure, especially for that particular story.
I mean, in many ways, the Silmarillion, because of how it's done, almost makes the whole other part of it seem more real, because, you know, you have two tales that were told, you know, like Homer doing Iliad and the Odyssey, you know, and then you have this other thing that just makes it feel like in the real world, you'd have this document of things that have, you know, events that have occurred over time, you know, and it does make the whole thing just feel like someone actually really did write this whole thing down about this history. Fantastic.
I do read it with the understanding that Tolkien probably would not have approved that it was out there. I mean, I have all these documents from a lot of the books that I've written, just from Last God, but also, what else? Warlords of Appalachia. Even some of my alien stuff. Like, there's all these world building documents that I have that are fleshed out. And very often by the time the story is actually finished and published and out there, it has moved past a lot of the early doc, or even like mid to late documents that I wrote about that place. Like, if I were to keel over dead here tonight, and then somebody got into my computer and published all the shit that they found, all the notes that I have, God, I would never stop spinning in my grave. Like, no one's supposed to see this shit. It's just notes for myself. I know that Tolkien had that kind of stuff too. Like, if you read the Book of Lost Tales,
yeah,
and then you read the Silmarillion, and just imagine what other notes he must have had when he was in the literal trenches. How different that stuff is, and how I'm sure he never intended for anyone to read that stuff.
So you'd be like Tupac, 10 years after you die, people still releasing new material from you.
Right, exactly. Yeah, some of that stuff is not supposed to see the light of day.
I wonder if Tupac thought the same thing about his music, like, no, that's not a good song, bury it. And then someone like 10 years later was like, hey, new song. He's like, son of a bitch.
I know, I gotta find all my old stuff. Like when I'm on my deathbed, trying to burn it all down. Even like some of my favorite albums are by Miles Davis and Gil Evans. And at some point they released an album, I think it was called Quiet Nights. That was their quote unquote last album, and it was never meant to be released. A lot of stuff that they recorded together that they ended up not being happy with, and that they never released. And then eventually, to make money, the label did release it against their wishes. And I do like those tracks, but it's not what they wanted.
So you write Action Comics for DC Comic Books, and then you also do Aliens for Marvel. So you're basically writing two high profile books for the two big franchises at the same exact time. So when you're writing for DC and writing for Marvel, how different is the experience from writing for one company versus writing for the other?
I mean, they're intensely different, but it's not so much because it's Marvel, it's because of the nature of the license on Alien. Alien, most of my notes come from 20th Century, which the entity used to be called Fox. I get the occasional note from the Marvel editors, but most of it's coming through Fox. So, and they are there to, I find they're there to kind of protect the brand, and very often just to kind of, freeze it in carbonite and not let it change. And it seems like that's the nature of the notes that I get are very protective. And I mean, of course, in a way, the DC editors are also meant to protect the characters and the IP and everything of DC Comics, but it doesn't mean that they don't let big things happen, So I find that when I'm working with Superman, I have such a clear vision of who Superman is, one that I believe in so deeply, and it lines up pretty well with the other writers that are doing Superman and with the editor that runs the Metropolis group and all that. We all work together very, very well. I mean, I've never gotten a note back that said anything like Superman would never do that. I mean, never. Like, I understand who Superman is. I'm not trying to lead him down this path of monumental change. I mean, with the Warworld saga, I am exposing him to a different kind of problem. I've been very vocal about how, like, Warworld saga is sort of about the issue of human trafficking, where you're trying to save people that don't think that they're in trouble, who don't know that they're in trouble, who don't want you there, who are kind of in this. They've been subjected to such long-term propaganda and abuse and brainwashing that they think Mongol is their Superman. They don't want Superman's help. But they literally wear the chains of his slavery. And Superman's there to save him from slavery and death, but they don't want his help. How do you solve a problem like that? So it's a hard problem. And at the beginning, he gets his ass kicked, and then we have to see him kind of crawl his way out. And that's definitely a challenge and a trial but I'm not trying to change Superman. The thing with Alien that is so challenging is that you're trying to capture the feeling that those early movies gave you without just showing us the same stuff over and over again. So you can't just show the dinner scene from the first. The thing, people ask me my favorite movie in the Alien series, and I have to say the first one. And it's not, I mean, as far as the craft, I think the second one, the Cameron, is probably the stronger film technically. That's the second movie is the one where we really see Ripley as a fully fleshed out character, and where we come from, where she comes from, and where she has to get to, like her whole emotional arc as a character. We see her building this whole new family around herself to replace someone that she's lost, and she's become so badass, but also so sympathetic in that second movie. She's not just an action marquee star. But that first one, dude, the reactions that those put in you, like the first movie is just a series of emotional car crashes, one after the next, where you're seeing something that's just blowing your fucking mind constantly. You see the ship and then the space jockey and then the eggs and the thing on the face and then the dinner scene. And then you see the big chap for the first time. And I mean, over and over, you're just like, what am I looking at? And it's just this mind-blowing experience. I can't even imagine seeing it for the first time after all these years. But you're trying to recapture those moments of, holy crap, what am I looking at? And this terribly invasive, gross cosmic horror, this the disgusting nature of its life cycle and the unknowable nature of this thing that's out there in the stars waiting to kill us. You're trying to capture that. And you can't do it by just showing the same thing over and over. You can't just show the dinner scene again.
Right.
Everyone's seen it. Everyone knows it. It's been on Animaniacs. Like it's not scary anymore by itself. So you're trying to capture that same feeling. So it's tricky. So you do have to carry the ball forward in these subtle ways that still achieve that gross sense of invasive, like kind of puckery horror. So when you get notes that no, that's not what the aliens do. You've got to push back. You've got to find ways to push the mythology forward, push the biology of it forward, just like in baby steps, you're not jumping the shark. So you don't want to take it too far. You don't want to introduce like a, you know, whatever, butterfly morph or anything stupid. You know, you've got to up the game regarding the what you're seeing on screens, so that you can still get that same feeling again, you know?
I think it's kind of interesting. On the one hand, you're writing Superman for action comic books, who obviously the idea is that your protagonist is your hero, your title character is your hero that you want to be victorious. With Aliens, your title characters are just the opposite. They're the ones who kind of have to lose. I imagine the humans or whatever are your primary, what you're supposed to empathize with. So, I mean, it's like a totally different thought process in how you got to, you know, the fans want to see aliens, but at the same time, for the story to make, for it to work, you can't have the aliens conquering the world. You know what I'm saying? It's kind of like a different entity. That must be a total change in how, a shift in how you think about your approach.
Yeah, it's, I do sometimes find sneaky ways for the aliens to kind of win. Like, I mean, not often do the aliens totally get taken off the board by the end. The aliens are like the cockroaches that you can never entirely eradicate, except they're bigger than you.
Yeah.
And so even though like we might show a character getting away now and again, like somebody surviving, not everyone survives. And in the end, there's still that cockroach under the floor that you don't know about. And, you know, just kind of remind the character, like people who've seen my, who've read my work up till now on Alien, like those last pages tend to show that, you know, who won really, you know, ... question mark.
Right.
So yeah, with Superman, we're trying to protect who he is. And Superman is an oak. Like he's who he is. He's the best of us. He represents what humanity should be and should want to be. The aliens is a completely, like almost a diametrically opposed kind of fantasy, where it's about this fear that we should always have. We should be afraid. There's something out there, and this nihilistic, bleak fear of what's out there. So it's as opposed to Superman, who shows us that you can be purely powerful and also purely compassionate and humble and kind. So yeah, they're very, very opposite kind of experiences as a writer.
And different perspectives of what an alien could be. The aliens come to either save us or the aliens are coming to destroy us. Gotta be careful reaching out to the universe.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like in the news recently, the Chinese are claiming that they've seen, like that they may have gotten a response from something from this big satellite dish that they have, like the, from an extraterrestrial, you know, signal. And I just want to be like, don't pick up. Don't do it. We're doing just fine here. Don't do it.
I think it was Stephen Hawking who said the same exact thing, which is you don't exactly want to know what's out there. You don't want to contact anybody. I think they, what they call it, the dark forest issue, where when you walk in the dark forest, you don't actually want to bump into anything. You're better off being by yourself the entire time.
Yeah. Like any, yeah, these voyages into the new world always turn out just great for everyone, don't they?
Right.
Well, yeah, let's leave it alone.
Well, you're writing another what sounds like another space opera. You're doing World Without a Justice League Green Lantern.
Yeah,
which sounds fantastic. I'm a huge Green Lantern fan. I've been buying their comic books for 33 years maybe at this point. So how did you get attached to the World Without a Justice League Green Lantern story?
They reached out. Paul Kaminsky, I think, my Superman editor, reached out about possibly doing that one. They thought I'd be a good fit for a Jon Stewart story. And when I grew up, Hal Jordan was always my Green Lantern. And I really like Hal. And I'd seen some stuff with Jon in it. Of course, I have like really quite old comics when Jon, like around the time that Jon first showed up. And I'd seen him, you know, in other comics over the years as he kind of comes in and out, but never a whole lot of like tentpole Jon Stewart stories. And of course, I saw him in the animated stuff, and he always seemed, the way he was portrayed always struck me as a little one-dimensional. And I but you know, I really like getting these calls to do these licensed books, do like books about licensed characters, especially like Big Two stuff, because very often it gives me a chance to bone up on a character, to get to know a character better than I did before. That's how my very first gig at DC, they reached out and like, would you want to do something? I'm like, hell yeah, I would. And he was like, well, here's all the books. It was Brian Cunningham, the Justice League editor at the time. And he said, here are the books I'm editing. And I don't remember all the ones that he said. He said Flash, Green Lantern, Aquaman, maybe the GL Core, Constantine, something else. And it's like, Constantine, all day. I know that character so well. I would crush that book. And he said, actually, what I really need is Aquaman.
I was like,
that's what I meant. Let's do it. And, you know, and it worked out great. I didn't know Aquaman that well, but it gave me an excuse to do a super deep dive on the character, to read up on stuff I hadn't really read before.
Yeah.
And I got to know that character. I needed to like teach myself to love Aquaman. And I totally did. I found my way in, you know, like what I wanted him to be, what I thought could make that character really epic. So I did. So at the time, they wanted me to do an inventory issue, which was it's a way that DC, at least back then, I'm not sure if they're still doing it or not, but they wanted to, as their way of kind of trying people out, they would, because there's got to be a book on the shelf every month. So sometimes when a creative team falls behind or whatever, they want to have an inventory issue kind of in the can that they can put out there whenever. Just as a kind of a fill-in issue. And it's good to have those in the bank in case you ever need it, but it's also a good way to try people out. So I did a two-issue Aquaman story that ended up becoming the Aquaman annual, I think it was 2018, with Max Fiumara and Dave Stewart. And that turned out really fun. So I was like, you know, I want to keep getting that experience. I want to get, you know, read up on a character that I might not have otherwise. So I read a lot of Jon Stewart. I spoke to Jeff Thorne, who's a Jon Stewart super fan. We talked about him a lot. And yeah, I kind of found my way in, because I still, from the old days, I still see Jon Stewart as an architect. And everyone else kind of writes him as like the, not everyone else, but many people write him as the ex-Marine. And he becomes kind of one note, a little one dimensional for my taste. Like, I don't want him to see him as just the military guy that makes big guns or makes green soldiers or makes, you know, talks in military lingo as imagined by civilians. It just always felt kind of fakey and it was kind of thin. And I wanted to get to know Jon a lot better. And I was really pleased to do it. And it kind of gave me a chance to just dip my toe into the Green Lantern universe, because there was so much stuff I wanted to do. But I thought for a long time that the Green Lanterns are like the Jedi of the DC universe, and they have this ancient history, and they're so goddamn epic in theory. Yeah. So I have all these big ideas about what they could be and how much bigger and older and cooler they could be. And I love seeing other writers take on that. Cause I mean, I know a lot of other writers feel the same way. It's been really cool to see what other people do with them. I think John Stewart got some heat online. Cause I said that John Stewart, in my opinion, is just the perfect ideal Lantern, like the obvious choice to be Green Lantern. I love Hal. So everyone else is like, what about Hal? What about you hate Hal Jordan. You hate Guy Gardner. You hate whoever. And I jumped on. I'm like, I almost threw shade at Guy Gardner just now. I'm going to keep that to myself. But I'm thinking it. And but Hal, I love Hal, but I think Hal is cool because he's kind of the dark horse. Like he's, I thought that Hal is the unlikely choice, and he ended up being one of the greats. You know, I love the idea that the ring picks him almost by accident. Like he finds the alien.
Yeah.
And the ring kind of flies out, is just, you know, accepts him right there on the spot in his face. Doesn't fly off to the cosmos. It takes the guy that's like standing right there. And he's this fearless pilot and all that, but he's also kind of a screw up and kind of just a hothead. And,
yeah,
you know, and he ends up being one of the greatest of all time. I think that's what makes Hal so cool as a choice. But I think that John Stewart, in contrast, was the obvious choice, like not just a great fighter, but also an architect and also a great leader of soldiers, like a master tactician and devastating warrior and all the things that makes a great Lantern. So I love writing John. And honestly, I think John might've become one of my favorites. I've always had a lot of affection for Kyle Rayner as well. Part because because he's an artist and he's all about pure creation. But also because that's when I was reading Green Lantern back in the day. I was reading when Ron was writing them, and when he created Kyle Rayner, I thought it was super dope. And I got a lot of affection for a lot of those guys, but I'm really into John Stewart right now, and it was a real pleasure to write him.
Well, as my own humble brag, I think I might have said it before on one of these shows, but my humble brag is I have every Green Lantern issue going back to the first issue of Silver Age, including annuals and shots, all the connections of all of them. I own them all.
Wow, dude.
Seriously, it's like 1,000 comic books over that actually by now. But I started with Hal Jordan in 89. The Green Lantern that became mine was Kyle Rayner. Nice. And Kyle Rayner has kind of had the short shaft or whatever you want to call it for, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years by now. So I think a lot of fans were hyped to hear Kyle Rayner showing up in this Green Lantern comic book. But there's a twist on you're bringing him in. You're bringing him in as the blind prophet, Kyle Rayner. So where does this come from? How did this come about? And is this a long-term status quo for him or something that's issue specific?
I'm not sure how much I should say regarding how long it's going to last, but it's... I will say, don't be disappointed if you don't see him on every page, because the comic is short and it's primarily a John Stewart story. The issue is not a long one. So in this particular issue, I would have loved to have written a lot more Kyle. I wanted to show a lot more Jason Todd as a Lantern that I think nobody expected.
Yeah,
I wanted one that nobody would expect, like Frank Castle, you know, Cosmic Ghost Rider is like, right. What? And then they explain how he became that. It makes total sense. And I really like that character, but I think Jason Todd would make a great Lantern, and I have my reasons for that. But Kyle to me is just unnaturally gifted at it. Like John Stewart is the perfect Lantern as far as being a military leader and fighter and everything. But Kyle Rayner is just this almost like a spiritual choice where he's just the perfect creator. And I love that about him. And I wanted to give a Paul Muad'Dib from Dune Messiah kind of take on him, where he's so, like, he's been horribly wounded and he's lost his eyes, but he's so gifted he doesn't need him anyway. Like he's so gifted with the ring, he can see just fine without him. And John Stewart is, in this book, he is the guardian, the capital G guardian of the Green Lantern Corps, because the others are gone by then. And he's kind of, he just took the, you know, picked up the mantle and became the man. And Kyle is like their spiritual leader, kind of. He's almost like the oracle of Lanterns. And I just love that character. I love that. I feel like he is the most gifted of the Lanterns. And I just love that character. I wish I could put more of him in that issue. And if I get to take the reins on Green Lantern someday, I'll definitely be bringing. I'm going to blind Kyle Rayner. You heard it here first. No, I just think Kyle's dope, and I want to use him more and more, and not just in Green Lantern. Wherever I can, I want to use that character.
Well, see, this now brings up two cards. One's a little more of a deep dive, and then we'll get to the other one. I'm sure you researched Green Lantern mythology for a while, and there's a character in Yellow Lantern. It's called, I think, Lisa Dark, who kind of is the one who writes the book of the Yellow Lantern, so Netrocore Bible. Is that kind of what Kyle Rayner is the equivalent of for the Greens at this point?
You know, I have to admit, I've not done the deep, crazy world building on Kyle's role yet. He is not so much, as far as whether he wrote a big book or not, to my knowledge, he is not. He's more of just like, he speaks for what the ring is. Like he speaks for Oa, basically. So they kind of look to him for guidance. They look to John to lead them, but they look to Kyle for guidance.
The one thing I've noticed about on these one shots based on these event comic books, and you know, I may have observed wrongly, but it seems to be the truth that when an author or one of the writers takes on one of these one shot stories that, you know, beyond what they normally write, they tend to be practicing for the ongoing titles coming up. I mean, just that just seemed to be the connection. I think
trying to get a spoiler enemy, you devil.
Right. Like I think it was like Batman when they did what the hell was the one where they looked into the future, and then they had one for Future's End. And the amount of writers for Future's End, I think Thorne was one as well for Future's End, who later end up writing the ongoing after, is pretty. The batting average is pretty damn good. That's all I'm saying. So my question is, will DC's batting average improve or not coming forward, do you think?
I don't mind answering this question because I don't know for a fact either way.
Okay.
So nobody has said, do this book. If I was an editor, that's what I would do. So I think it depends on how this book is received, right? And not just by readers, but also by the editors. Like, I think that if editorial is happy with what we did here, I think it's possible. And I think I've expressed interest in it, and they've already kind of pegged me as the world building guy. Like the fact that I wrote an insane, like my hard drive is like half Word document notes of for Last God. Yeah. And they know how much work I put into that book, and that I put every bit as much work into my license work as I do my creator own. Because I care about it, man. I really like. I love the opportunity to write Superman. This is a big deal to me. Like, to me, the character of Superman is such an important thing because he represents the best of humanity. And people look to Superman to see, you know, what we should be. And he has this kind of cultural importance that I care about deeply. And I understand that not everyone feels the same way about Superman as I do. Not everyone sees him as important as I do. But I do see him that way. I see writing Action Comics, the legacy Superman book is this monumental honor and responsibility that I do not take lightly at all. It affects decisions that I make in my day. Mm-hmm. Like if I'm about to light somebody up online, I'm like, somebody's gonna be disappointed if I do that. Mm. So I try to hear Superman's voice in my head all the time. And I met a guy at West Point Academy. I was recently brought up to West Point Academy to do a little thing on writing there. And at the end of one of these classes that I gave, a guy named Monty came up to me. Monty had been trying to catch up with me all day, and he had been delayed elsewhere with some other class stuff. And he caught up with me at one of my after hours classes, and he showed up and walked his ass off across campus to get there. And he was like, I gave out some books at the end to people who wanted them. And he was hoping for an issue of Last God, and I didn't have any to give him. I'd already given them away. But we spoke at a great length when it was over. And turns out, and I kind of spoiled the fact that we had not announced Green Lantern yet. I told him I was about to write it, and he flipped shit because apparently he is the biggest John Stewart fan alive. And this is a West Point cadet, okay? And this is the place where the class ring was, where it became a thing. That whole concept began at West Point. And he said that when he graduates, he's going to design his ring to look as much like a Green Lantern ring as he can possibly get away
with. Awesome.
he really identifies with John Stewart, and not just because he kind of, I mean, the dude looks like John Stewart straight up, but that's not why he loves him. He talked at great length about how the fact that he's a part of something bigger, and not just the Justice League, but a part of like the Green Lantern Corps, the part of this gigantic thing that's so much older and bigger and, you know, and just the gravitas of it, so much more epic than he is as a human being. Mm. I mean, he gave me this little talk about why he loves Green Lantern, John Stewart Green Lantern so much. And in doing so, he told me why he's at West Point and why he's in the army, basically. And not without meaning to, that's what he was telling me.
Oh, that's cool.
So yeah. So the fact that to me, like, I regard Superman in the light in which he sees John Stewart.
Mm.
So it would be a great honor to write John Stewart as well. And if I got the opportunity, I would pitch him. The ideas that I have for Green Lantern are big. I don't know if I'll get away with it big, but if they do let me get away with it, I would love to write that book.
Well, like I said, my guy's Kyle Rayner, but if, or let's say has,
I love Kyle Rayner. If I get to write that book, Kyle's going to be in there in a big way.
I would hope so. He was, I mean, much as I enjoyed Jeffrey Thorne's run, he forgot Kyle Rayner, in my opinion. I will admit, and I think Kyle Rayner was forgotten. It's always been my feeling in Green Lantern that since Hal Jordan was brought back by Geoff Johns, it was important to underplay Kyle Rayner to build back up Hal Jordan, because you couldn't have them both be the best. Right. And Rayner was obviously the best for a decade in comics because, you know, the Torchbearer. So that's always my thing, that he kind of had to play down Rayner to build up Jordan to make it work. But the important question I was going to ask is, has the editors of Green Lantern approached you and said, what would you do with Green Lantern if you had an ongoing, which tends to be also the precursor to maybe having an ongoing?
you're asking if they approached me about that?
Have they asked you, what would you do with an ongoing if you were giving it to you?
No.
Okay.
But I mean, I don't know. I know we have good relationships on Superman. I know Superman's Action Comics is being very well received right now.
Hmm.
And I think, and we all get along super great. We have good working relationships. Everything's good. And I mean, they're going to have to pry Action Comics out of my cold, dead hands. I mean, I love doing that book, and it means a lot to me. But, you know, something like how it goes is they freshen up creative teams all the time. So at some point, they'll take me off of it. And that seems as likely a place as anywhere. And I've made my feelings on John known. And honestly, on how to, man, and Kyle, like all those characters, I don't know all of them as well as I would like. If they were like, "What should you do a Simon Baz book?" I'd have to learn a lot about Simon the way I did about John.
Yeah.
Honestly, a lot more so. Like, I don't know enough about Simon. I've seen him in books, of course.
Hmm.
Same with Jessica Cruz and Guy, but I just have to. I mean, everyone's going to be. The thing is, there have been so many now that somebody's going to be disappointed no matter what, unless they're all in it.
Right.
And even then I'm gonna catch. I learned very quickly that if you show love for a particular lantern, everyone else piles on if it's not their guy. So
well the only solution is you're gonna have to write more than one Green Lantern book. You gotta write Green Lantern Hal Jordan, Green Lantern Corps, usually that's John Stewart, and then Green Lantern Kyle Rayner as well. So you got three Green Lantern books you kind of have to work on at this point to make everybody happy. That's kind of your goal now.
Right. Somebody like, well, now you got to do a Guy Gardner book, and I'm going to be like, no, I got to do the Jason Todd book first. I'll get to Guy after that. They'd love that.
But, you know, I think one thing great about Green Lantern, there's so many possibilities for that character, so many places you can take that, you know, because you have, you know, I always love the stories where, you know, your Earth, you're fighting like, you know, Hector Hammond, you know, the small Earth ones, and you have but you can also enjoy the epic stories that they've done with, like I said, Geoff Johns had for a long time. I mean, there's so many possibilities with that character.
Yeah, there's a lot I want to do. I mean, as far as leaving anyone out in the cold, like the characters, I feel like what writers should do, in my opinion, is find everyone, like the core that makes everyone who they are, and let the character embrace that role and see how they play together. And rather than be like, who's the best? Like, I mean, as a fan of jazz music, like, how do you compare, you know, Charlie Parker to Cannonball Adderley to John Coltrane to, you know, how do you compare all the greats of one instrument to each other? 'Cause when they're so, like, they're not trying to do the same thing. You know, yeah. they're all their strengths are different. Like you can't compare, you know, the different members of the pantheon of the greatest of all time. Like it's just stupid.
Right. And I think the weird thing about Green Lantern, I think, is for, once again, a lot of fans over the last 20 years, for a little while, Green Lanterns had 4 or 5 titles. You had the Green Lantern titles, you had the Red Lantern titles, you had Sinestro Corps title. With Geoff Johns issue 12 ending, this has been in many ways the longest gap Green Lantern has had without an ongoing title since the post Kyle Rayner issue 181 leading into Rebirth. So it's a weird time for Green Lantern fans that we don't have a title right now, it looks like, to latch on to, which is kind of nice that, I mean, we're without a Green Lantern, without a Justice League Green Lantern story. It's pretty much the one, you know, solo Green Lantern comic we're going to be getting apparently for the near future, it looks like. So there's a lot of expectations on you to make this
stop,
work, because it's been a while.
Fishing you. I'm not going to help you. I can't help you. These are not the drugs you're looking for.
Well, one other thing that I think was interesting with your Green Lantern is you mentioned Jason Todd, who I think if you ask a lot of fans, what is there any characters that you would not or not you would think as Green Lanterns? Jason Todd is probably on top of that list. I mean, he's been an anti-hero for a while now. He's been kind of messed up from having been killed, brought back. So what was about Jason Todd you thought to yourself, this is a Green Lantern?
I mean, part of it is just because how much I love Jason Todd. I think the DC universe is full of characters who in theory would make great lanterns. I mean, Batman, obviously.
Yes.
we're looking for sheer willpower. Batman's the obvious choice, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the other people in his crew would also be super great at it. I mean, people in the super family too, like in, you know, Justice, I mean, God, Cyborg, there's so many characters we've got that would make awesome Green Lanterns just because they all have such great willpower and have shown it in their respective books. The thing about Jason that stood apart for me, besides just how much I love him personally. Okay. So one is how much I love him. So this is my own bias. Two is that I think I want to see, this is a world without a Justice League. So that means there's never been a Clark Kent there, no Batman, no the people who died or whatever. This place is free of their influence. And I want to see Jason Todd in a world in which he never met Batman. Mm-hmm. You got this homeless kid in Gotham who never, you know, jacked the tires off the Batmobile and instead was kind of taken under the wing of maybe the Court of Owls, maybe the Al Ghuls. In the story that I envisioned, he was taken under the wing of the Al Ghuls. And also just the Gotham underworld for a while, but then later the Al Ghuls and had, like, imagine this crazy, like, loves to fight kind of kid who later follows the same, like a similar kind of path to Batman, but then the ring chooses him. Mm. And I know someone else online told me, I always kind of pegged him. I figured he would have been a Red Lantern of anything.
I can see that.
And I refute that because, I mean, Red Lantern to me is about rage and the desire to kill for revenge. And it's just, yeah, it's about rage. And to me, Jason Todd is not full of rage. He's just this fearless kid who likes to fight. He's kind of like in your face, like, you know, I dare you kind of a thing. It's more about ego and it's about not being afraid. And to me, I think he'd be a great choice, but also I think he would be an extremely visually interesting choice because this is a world in which Jon Stewart has taught the others how to better use their powers. He's going to help the rest of the core to level up. So now instead of putting on a ring and your spandex suit appears, instead in the place where you once existed, there now exists this gigantic construct that exists in your place. So instead of creating just, you know, a thing on top of your skin, you're becoming this other thing. Like it creates another thing. So when you see Jon Stewart in the book, quote unquote, transform into his Green Lantern self, that's not armor he's wearing. He's becoming this, like an actual literal Emerald Knight that's made of this other thing. He's becoming and his armor better befits who he is as a person. It's like it's a hard light construct that as he sees himself. So he becomes, you see the Spartan cape and helmet appear and this badass spear thing that he makes. He's a warrior, he's a general, you know, and Jason Todd looks like an Afro samurai kind of bad guy, anti-hero thing. He's got the big ass gun blade thing like you'd see in a Final Fantasy game.
Yeah.
And he just looks so dope. I want him to look like the most badass manga character you can envision. You
know? that's cool.
And Natasha Irons is a Green Lantern in that story too. And you see, she becomes this gigantic mech. And Kyle Rayner, of course, is the Blind Prophet. So everyone just becomes a better version of them. They don't all create complete replacement versions of themselves, but some of them do. And like John does, and some of the other ones do as well. So that's one of the, yeah, I just want to see them take, like the Green Lantern should be versions of the Jedi that, like these peacekeepers that are not, that don't even have the same limitations as the Jedi do. Like they're bound by nothing but their own will and creativity. So I'd like to see that taken a lot further and like take to nth degree. Like back in the 90s, I remember Iceman getting messed with by Emma Frost, I think. Like Emma Frost or somebody took control of his mind and helped him. And when he was being possessed, he became vastly more powerful. And then he started that kind of messed with his head after that. And he started actually trying to get more badass with his powers. And we saw him really level up as like an omega level mutant. And I want to see the whole Green Lantern Corps level up and become omega level.
So once again, they spin out of Dark Crisis, which is the big event right now in the DC universe. How tightly connected to Dark Crisis are these stories and all the other World Without Justice League stories? Can you buy just one, or do you have to buy all the one shots for it to make sense? Do you have to buy Dark Crisis to make this make sense?
No, this is a standalone story that will stand on its own, but it does inform the story of Dark Crisis. It's tied super closely to Dark Crisis. Like it's, if you just get this one book and none of the others, you will not be punished. If you just get the Dark Crisis numbered books and not this one, you will not be punished, but they do tie together and they do reward each other if you read them all. And that's kind of how that's been the case in pretty much every one-shot tie-in thing I've done. It was the same kind of thing with Captain America Empire that I did. And gosh, what else are some other examples? Tales of the Dark Multiverse and yeah, any kind of tie-in thing that I did, they all kind of reward the reader the more they read, but they don't walk away feeling cheated that they didn't read everything. Because that's, I mean, as a reader myself,
right?
I always kind of get annoyed when that happens.
So when can our readers find World Without Justice League Green Lantern?
I'm sorry, when can they find?
Yeah, when is it released?
I should know that. I'm pretty sure it's August. I'm not 100% sure. Yeah.
Well, like I said, I mean, I think my listeners, if they're Green Lantern fans like me, like I am, we're looking forward to reading this comic book. I think it's fantastic. Like I said, I think what you're doing with Action Comics is fantastic. So as always, this is going to be an exciting read, I think, for,
thanks, brother,
for
our listeners. And I will say, if I do get the nod to do the ongoing down the road, this is definitely a glimpse into what that would look like. So and, I very much hope you dig it.
And you need to come on the show and talk about it. This is, if you do Green Lantern, you must come on the show and talk about it.
That's my big takeaway. This is the place to talk about Green Lantern. So I'll definitely do that. You too, Jeff. Thanks so much. You too. Bye.